How do you go from being at the wrong place at the right time to being at the right place at the wrong time and winning big time nevertheless? I'm Greg Gallant, and welcome to Venture Voice, show number 7 with Evan Williams. Evan has what you might almost think of as a typical dot-com story if it weren't for the timing and some of his unique approaches. Evan's company developed its marquee product, Blogger, back in 2002 when it all of a sudden wasn't cool to be a dot-com guy anymore. Nor was it even cool to be a blogger. Back then, it was mostly geeks blogging. It didn't grab the media spotlight from newspapers for a while on. Nevertheless, it was Blogger that empowered many people to get on that bandwagon. Evan's persistence paid unexpected dividends when Google acquired his company, and he joined Google as the program manager of Blogger. He stayed there for almost 2 years and is now back off on his own, running what is turning out to be one of the hottest companies in podcasting, Odeo. It offers a way to organize, view, and eventually create podcasts. You may even be listening to Venture Voice through Odeo right now. If you're not, you might want to try it. Now, speaking of timing, you're in the right place at the right time. Evan, for the first time publicly, announces in this show a certain milestone that his company has reached that will have huge impact on their future growth. So listen up. Evan, welcome to Venture Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So I saw you started your career with O'Reilly, as far as I could tell. Was that your first gig, or how'd you end up there?
O'Reilly was my first real job, so to speak. However, I did actually start a company or two before having that gig, back in Nebraska, where I grew up. And I started with a little publishing company. I ended up doing CD-ROMs and multimedia when that was all the rage in like 93, 94. And then morphed that into an internet company, actually, around that time, which was quite early. I always called that, I was in the wrong place at the right time. So I was trying to build an internet company in 94 in Nebraska. I was mostly explaining what the internet was to folks, but did that for a couple years before coming out to California.
So I've talked to people before for my show who are in New York or in Chicago, and they tell me that it's hard to do an internet company there. But I guess Nebraska is even more challenging.
Right. Yeah, I listened to your show with DeCostolo in Chicago, and pales in comparison to Nebraska in challenges. I assume Nebraska's gotten better, and there's certainly people around there who know what they're doing now. When we were there, it was very difficult to find talent, and not that we knew what we were doing either, so that didn't particularly help. We didn't know what we were lacking, you do what you can with where you are.
Well, you escaped and you got to O'Reilly. Was that a breeding ground for entrepreneurs? Did you get something useful out of that?
Yeah, O'Reilly was great. I went there in early 97, which was kind of the boom times, and I had my company in Nebraska had pretty much fizzled out and wasn't going anywhere, and that was about a 3 or 4 year very stressful learning experience for me in my first entrepreneurial venture. And came out to California and joined O'Reilly as a way to get to California. And it was great. It was the first. O'Reilly's a great company. It's a unique little company. It's up in Sebastopol, which for those who aren't around the Bay Area is a small town. It's about 7,000 people up in wine country, about an hour north of the city. When you're in Nebraska, that's pretty much the same thing as San Francisco. Once you get here, it's a little bit different, but it's a cool little company. I worked in the software group, which doesn't exist anymore, but the software group was kind of a startup in itself, and got to do a lot of things, got to work with some really smart folks. I didn't work there very long because I just found that, well, A, I was never good working for other people, and B, just being a single person coming to California and wanting to be involved in stuff up in wine country wasn't exactly the place to be. But the O'Reilly connections were great, and you probably saw I ended up doing well through them later in life and later ventures. So I was always glad I had the opportunity to be there.
So can you tell me about the day that you decided to quit and what was going through your head? Did you have your next business venture in your mind already, or you just wanted to get out and see what was out there?
I didn't have a venture in mind yet. I wasn't quite ready to do that. I always knew I'd start another company, but at that time I had developed some skills, just self-taught, for building web apps. And at O'Reilly I was actually doing more marketing. Oddly enough, I quit O'Reilly. I don't even know if I had a particular plan, but I thought I could get some gigs doing freelance web application development. And ended up, before my last day, I got a gig at O'Reilly doing web application development. So I left my job on a Friday and came back on Monday as a contractor in a different department working on an intranet application. And so I was still at O'Reilly for a couple more months. And then I eventually got down to Silicon Valley, and I worked at Intel for a while as a contractor, and then HP, and I did just contract development for a couple years.
So from all that development, what was kind of the impetus to start Praia Lab and go off on your own and really build something for yourself?
Like I said, I always knew I was going to start another company, so after a couple years, or I guess it was about a year and a half of doing the development and learning more stuff and being sort of in the middle of Silicon Valley during the boom, I finally, you know, kind of got rested up and decided it was time to do that new venture. So we started Pyra and actually started conceptualizing and working on it in late 98, and then officially launched that and incorporated in January of 99 with my co-founder.
What was your first product with Pryor? What was the original conception of what to do? Was that Blogger then, or did that come later?
No, Blogger didn't come till a little later. So it's Pyra, by the way, Pyra Labs. I actually started it to develop some ideas around collaboration, and we were aiming to build a web application for personal and project management. It was sort of hard to articulate, but I had some particular ideas about collaborating online and tracking personal information online, meaning like PIM type stuff, like to-dos and tasks and notes and that type of stuff combined in an environment where you could collaborate and share projects, and had this sort of elaborate vision of the super information manager that we started building. And that was the basis for the company, and we started out building that in early 99. And at the same time, it was three people: Meg Horham, my co-founder and friend who started working with us soon thereafter, Paul Bausch, and myself. We each had our own weblogs, as they're normally called at the time, sort of on our personal sites. And I had the idea for Blogger from early on after starting Pyra, but it just wasn't the thing we were doing. We didn't see it as a huge thing, and saw this uber complicated information manager as a much more practical business idea. So kind of put it on the back burner in the back of my mind for a few months, and then we just finally decided to build it sort of on a whim in later that year in August.
What was your intention for it to be used for? Did you think that it would be kids blogging about what happened at school that day, or business people talking about their profession?
Originally, we designed it for web geeks, really. I mean, it was for ourselves and people who we thought were like us. So we were web developers, so we kind of saw this idea of weblogs taking off. Said, well, that's a pretty cool format, and to change our personal sites too. We all had personal sites before that were more static. And we thought, well, it certainly makes our lives a lot easier if we just, you know, write this little app that lets you post to it with just a form, and you don't have to fire up an FTP client or a command line to transfer files, and you can do all this stuff of just typing in a form. But the original design of Blogger actually required that you already had a website, and we just FTP'd the file to your site, which is a feature of Blogger that still exists that a lot of people don't even know about. But for the entire first year of Blogger's existence, it required that. So it was really designed for a slightly technical crowd who just needed a little content management system. We actually, in the early days, referred to it as lightweight content management, because we saw, well, a lot of people have sites, and it wasn't that putting up a site or designing a site was the hard thing or the thing we were trying to solve. It's just the maintenance or posting to it on a regular basis. So we saw it more as the personal publishers who were, you know, slightly geeky, sort of the web geek crowd, like we called them at first.
It sounds ironic in that now you see most of the users of it tend to be people who don't know that much about the technical end, and the technical people use more complex blogging software. What did you do to kind of ramp up the adoption and make it appealing to people who don't know what HTML is?
Yeah, it had an interesting trajectory through the years in that it always tended toward the more and more mainstream. And that was a big challenge, because since it was originally designed for geeks, when we started trying to appeal to less technically adept audience, everything was designed still for these geeks, and we didn't want to take features away from the geeks, but those were actually the complicated parts of the system that caused us and the newbie users a lot of headaches. So the ability, like FTP servers, I don't know anything about that, and working with all these different servers. There are actually a lot of things built into the system that if we would have designed it for people who didn't know all that stuff in the first place, it would have been much simpler. That said, it's those geeks and those kind of early adopters that helped Blogger get a lot of adoption at first, so it's not that I wouldn't have done that. But basically, a year after we launched it, we actually launched Blogspot, which was the hosting service, because we just saw the need and saw, well, turns out a lot of people want to blog and they don't necessarily have websites. So it's just kind of a no-brainer to build the hosting service. We just thought maybe we'd plug in more easily to other hosting services, but thought, well, the easiest thing to do is build our own. And the reason it was on Blogspot rather than Blogger is because the idea that we still wanted to work with others. We wanted to make the focus on the publishing tool, not necessarily the hosting service, and make it more modular. So once we launched Blogspot so you could do everything from that site is when it really turned the corner to a more less technical audience service. But then over the years, it went more that way. So even after, especially after we went to Google.
So can you tell me about the Google acquisition, how they get interested in you, and how did you guys handle interest from a company like Google?
Well, at the time of the Google acquisition, we were about 4 years in to Blogger, and I had been, you know, up and down a roller coaster during those 4 years, from early starting out during the boom, you know, bootstrapping till we launched, raised a little bit of money, running out of money and lay everybody off but me, and then building it back up again. And so it was late 2002 when Google came knocking, and we were sort of on a roll. I mean, blogging over those years continued to grow. We sort of managed to bootstrap the service into making a little bit of money via the Blogger Pro and other paid services. Grew the team back up a little bit. We had a handful of people. And we actually had an offer on the table to raise another round of money, the first money that we would have raised since early 2000. And so we were feeling pretty good. And when Google approached us at first, we didn't even know why they wanted to talk to us. But of course, they were Google, so we went and talked. And, you know, it came out right away that they wanted to know what we thought about selling to them. And that was a surprise, of course. I don't really know that much of the backstory about why they came to talk to us. I mean, it was sort of an idea someone had, so someone put together, and we started talking.
As an entrepreneur, once you were in Google, though, how did it feel? I guess it's an entrepreneurial company, but at the same time, sounds as though you're very independent and haven't stayed with any other companies for too long.
Oh, right. Well, I haven't been in very many companies for too long to try and stay in, but once we got to Google, it was very exciting. I mean, it took about 4 months from when we started talking to when we actually were commuting down to Mountain View, and they hired the whole team, and which was a whopping 6 people, and it was tremendously exciting. I mean, Google was a tiny company then compared to what they are now, but they were still very highly respected, and that was still during the time where this kind of semi-boom we're experiencing now wasn't really started, and Google is one of the few companies out there that was making money, and or apparently making money, that wasn't even very public yet, and, you know, doing really cool stuff. So out of all the companies to be bought by, obviously it was sort of a dream scenario. And we got there, and it was very exciting. I was there for about a year and 8 months, and during that time, Google, you know, just was on this chaotic growth spurt, which they're still on. Went public during that time, launched a bunch of other businesses, and when we got there, everyone was surprised. Like, Google's a search company in most people's mind, maybe secondarily an ad company, but they certainly weren't a blogging company or a more general internet web company, whereas now they have Gmail and Orkut and all these other services where you could see, well, blogs maybe fit in. But at the time, it was just, we're the first company that actually acquired that even had any people, and we're the first website they owned that wasn't on Google.com. And it was just like a lot of firsts and a lot of craziness, and a lot of people inside as well as out didn't know why we were there.
So the rest of Google aside, do you think that Blogger was developed as well inside of Google as it would have been if it were still on its own with you and you as the CEO?
You never know what could have been. I mean, it's hard to say. I think it was developed differently than it would have otherwise, and we got a lot of luxuries from Google that there's no way an independent company would have ever gotten. I mean, the priorities changed a lot once we got to Google. It was a company of Google scale, and Google in particular, all about volume. And so we learned pretty quickly that the little bit amount of money we were making before we got there that kind of paid the bills and we were kind of excited about just was trivial. And it was actually more efficient to get rid of that income stream than it was to maintain it. And it, because until Blogger was Google sized, it just wasn't interesting at the corporate level. So got to do a lot of cool things and make everything free, but at the same time, Blogger wasn't the highest priority in Google, so we also had to compete for things that we never had to compete with before. But I think Blogger's in a great place today. It was a little bit of a struggle to get there, but I think it's going well, and to Google's credit, they didn't screw it up, which is what a lot of companies do with tiny companies when they buy them.
So looking back, is there any one thing that you say that you could say that you've learned from Google as an entrepreneur that you're starting to apply now?
Yeah, I think actually I don't know if there's one thing I could say I've learned. There's a ton of stuff I learned at Google, which is extremely valuable, and that I'm trying to apply now. And that was part of my thinking when I went there. It wasn't a no-brainer decision to do the acquisition for me, exactly because it'd been so independent and been such a long road building Blogger and thought what things were looking up. Went to Google specifically because I thought it is the best path to reach Blogger's potential, and secondarily because I knew I'd learn more at Google and from the people at Google than any other path. So the biggest thing I always come back to learning at Google is their ability to think big, and that was something I was always impressed with even when I was there. Every time I saw Larry or Sergey speak, or the way they tackled a question was always at a higher level or thinking bigger than most people dare to think. And when you're an independent company, it's especially hard to do that when you're a small company. I think those guys always did that. And certainly when you're bootstrapping, it's hard to do that. But the ability to just think audaciously huge ideas, like at the time when they did, it was like, oh, we're going to index the whole web. That was kind of crazy. And you see it in a lot of things like Gmail, we're going to give away a gig of space. And things that just changing the metrics on people is a fascinating discipline to have, and something that I think speaks to their phenomenal success.
So how are you thinking big now with audio?
That's a good question. I think we're thinking big, and we're thinking audio is everywhere. It's the most ubiquitous medium there is, and we want to be the best source for finding and subscribing and, you know, listening to audio as well as creating it. And we have lots of big ideas around that, and we're trying to be the one-stop shop that does lots of different things, and as well as being open at the same time, and make lots of stuff free and as easy as possible for tens of millions of users.
So how did you come up with this idea? I mean, now it seems you can't read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal without coming across a podcasting article.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But I guess a few months ago, it wasn't out there.
No, and I've been very surprised by the trajectory of the podcasting as much as anyone, I think. And the way I came to podcasting was sort of separate from all the hype that's been going on. And it was last year, when this story I tell in my blog about how audio happened for me was I'm talking to Noah Glass, my co-founder, who started the service that is offered, co-branded by Google, called Audio Blogger, and it was the first tool that you call up on the phone and leave a message, and it got posted as an MP3 to the web via the blogging APIs. We did a deal with him to have a Blogger-branded version of that called Audio Blogger, and it was in talking with him that we got to this idea of downloading to the iPod. Now, at the same time, other people had the same idea and were ahead of us and developed stuff faster than we did, notably Adam Curry and Dave Weiner, and other folks who were really pushing this idea, and I think it's a symbol that a lot of the ideas just kind of are in the air, but I certainly give those guys credit for developing it quickly. But the way we came to it is just looking at Audio Blogger and saying, well, this is really cool that people can post audio to their blogs. I always thought that was a nice service and wanted to offer it to Blogger server users, but I didn't find that I actually listened to the audio when I came across it. And at the same time, I was commuting down to Google every day, down 101, and I bought an iPod and subscribed to audible.com specifically to pass the time on that commute. And I found that as much as I like music, 9 times out of 10, I would be more interested in listening to someone talk about a subject of interest to me than I would be to listen to music, especially when I'm driving. So I thought, well, we're all about publishing. We're all about personal publishing and helping people get their voice out there. And we do this with audio, but why does it have to be trapped on the web? And it's like, the place I want to listen to it is in my car via this device I bought specifically for listening to things. So, and I hook it to my computer, so why couldn't we just transfer the independent, fresh content to my iPod every day and I listen to that on my commute to work instead of these books? So that was sort of the aha moment I had back last fall, and then shortly after that, or I tuned into other people talking about podcasting. I was encouraging Noah to do it at the time. I wasn't really involved, and I was still at Google at first, and then when I quit Google, I still wasn't involved full-time with Odeo. I was just sort of advising Noah, and then finally kind of got sucked in earlier this year.
I don't know if you'd have the stats for it, but it seems as though cities with worse traffic and longer commute times are going to have faster and faster adoption rates for podcasting.
I would guess so. I was trying to do some research on how much time that the average American spends commuting, and it's something like 24 minutes a day, which I thought is wonderful. I mean, I think a lot of people in the Bay Area would certainly love to have a 24-minute each-way commute. I don't know if that 24 minutes was combined or not. So I think you're right. I think you'll see a lot of adoption in the cities. Then again, the flip side of that, as I started digging into podcasting, just the idea of audio content in general, I became fascinated by the fact that obviously there are a lot of parallels to blogs. And while blogs have grown tremendously over the last 5 or 6 years since we first got into it, one thing I noticed that the people who really read blogs and participated in the blogosphere, one determining factor is how much time they spent in front of a computer every day. So people whose either job it was or hobby it was to be on the web all the time were those who were blogging. And I don't know what the numbers are, but it seems like there's a hell of a lot more people in the world who don't spend their days in front of a computer than there are that do. And everyone from the postman who's walking around delivering the mail to someone working in their garden or a million other jobs or lives that don't involve sitting in front of a computer, to me, this says that the potential for audio content is possibly much greater than that of blogs, and as far as reaching a really mainstream audience.
So I guess you're thinking bigger now than you were with Blogger.
Possibly, yes.
And you're thinking big, but so is Steve Jobs at Apple, and Audible's thinking big, and so is Adam Curry and Dave Weiner, like we were talking about. And Odeo's, as you were saying, a one-stop shop. Do you see, are you competing head-on with all these guys, or are you all going to peacefully coexist?
Somewhere in between there, I think. I don't think we're competing head-on with anyone right now. I think there's a tremendous amount of activity and innovation in the space, obviously, and lots of startups that you didn't name as well as those you did, as well as the big players, like the Googles and Yahoos aren't going to ignore this either. First of all, I think it's, there's room for a lot of players, A. B, I think a lot of the services are complementary. So whereas Apple came in and they saw the same, a lot of the same problems we did and other people did, to see, well, this medium has a lot of potential, but it's just from the average user experience level, it's got some challenges and we want to make that easier. You know, they approached that a lot of the same ways we did, and that's one of the problems we're trying to solve with Odeo.com. They're solving it with iTunes. They're leveraging a lot of the technology they already had, as well as obviously a substantial user base and a phenomenal brand. And they're able to get that solution out there and make a huge leap forward for the podcasting world. You could look at it that as competitive, but on the other hand, from the Odeo side, they also made it much, much easier to use Odeo. So if you go and you sign up for Odeo now, you say, hey, you have iTunes 4.9. One click, you can have your Odeo subscriptions in iTunes instead of before we required you to download our Syncr application, which was like iPod, or you could use any of the other third-party apps. But from a beginning standpoint, you had to download this 9-meg file and install it and log in, and now it's a matter of one click, and we feel we still offer a lot of value above and beyond that. So if they want to take care of the plumbing of this, that's great. And I think it'll, in the end, result in more people using Odeo, and they do work well together, and you could get some of the same podcasts in the iTunes podcast directory as you can get in Odeo. We think we're going to add a lot of value on top of just the basic subscription mechanism. And if you want to pull them down in iTunes, that's great. And in that case, I think they do work peacefully together. And a lot of the other cases, we're trying to be open, as I was saying before, the one-stop shop, but that's open at both ends. So if you want to use our creation tools, that's great. You'll still be in the iTunes directory and the other directories. And if you use Cast Blaster or some other publishing tool, probably you want to still be in Odeo for the distribution. So I think there's going to be a lot of... Today, I don't think any internet ecosystem or medium does exist without lots of cooperation. There's not going to be an eBay in any world where one company pretty much owns the marketplace.
What have the numbers been like for you in terms of adoption, especially since the iTunes 4.9, the iTunes with podcasting support? Has that increased your total usage or not affected it?
Well, iTunes 4.9 actually was launched publicly before Odeo. So it's only been a couple of weeks for us since we met out in the public. We had about 10,000 invitations that we sent out a few weeks ago before we opened the doors publicly, and those are just people who signed up on the site before. So it's really too early to tell. iTunes was out first. iTunes, I think it's safe to say, has bigger numbers than we do at this point, but we're definitely seeing growth, and we're just getting started, so I'm feeling pretty good about it.
Steve Jobs, watch out.
We work well together. I'm sticking with that story.
Great. And how is Odeo funded?
Odeo is, up until today, actually, was just angel-funded by myself and most recently one other angel, and we just closed some venture funding today that we're going to be announcing next week, actually.
Oh, congratulations. So are we breaking that right here?
I suppose, depending on when this goes out. I'm not going to tell you who yet because it's actually a combination of some angels and a VC, and I need to get sign up from all them to use their names. But we have a great group of investors, and we're really excited about it.
Great. Well, I guess I'm going to have to do my post-production a little bit faster than usual then. To the podcasters out there, do you think there's a business for them? Do you think we're going to see a lot of people making a living just off creating a podcast?
I think there are definitely going to be people who make livings creating podcasts, or more generally related to podcasts. In a bunch of different ways. I don't want to hype that idea too much. I think creating content is a tough business in all mediums, no matter who you are. And content is a tougher and tougher way to make money. And there will be money made by podcasting, just like there is money made in different mediums, assuming that the audience continues to grow and they want good stuff, and that money will come from advertising and it'll come from selling content. But the majority of people aren't going to make money by creating content. And just like majority of people who put up websites or blogs don't make money doing that, and they do it for other reasons. They make money indirectly, or they do it just because for the love of it or a hobby or to connect with other people. And then there's commercial entities that do it as a part of their business. But there will be money made. I think it's going to take a while to figure out. And then there's going to be ancillary services that I think could create interesting businesses for folks. So for, say, production of content or I don't even know what the businesses might be at this point, but I think it's going to be a rich ecosystem with a lot of opportunities.
Great. I don't think you're going to like this question, but I know you're a big fan of Flickr, which has now been acquired by Yahoo, and you started Blogger that was acquired by Google. If once this takes off, if both of these guys come along and they're interested in getting into the podcasting space and you're made a tempting offer, who would you rather be acquired by, Yahoo or Google?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure how I can win answering that question. I also don't know that Google want to acquire me again. But they have different strengths. If you look at the types of companies, while they get compared a lot, they're really different types of companies DNA-wise. Google is very, very much a technology company. And Yahoo is a little bit more of a media company. It seems like the moves Yahoo's making in recent months that they're becoming more technology-driven than they were. They seem really clued into the personal web and Web 2.0 type ideas, which are really exciting. It's more that they really get the social aspects of the web, and they haven't exactly nailed all of those yet with Yahoo 360. And with Flickr, they're certainly trying, and I think they got a lot of the right ideas. Whereas Google, I think, is farther behind on those things. And in terms of what we're not looking to sell the company to either Yahoo or Google anytime soon. So it's a very hypothetical question, and just commenting on their strengths and weaknesses. I think podcasting is going to fit with Yahoo's strengths pretty well because they are more of a media company, and they also get the social web a little bit more. But you know, someone at Google, certainly there are lots of people at Google who get it, and they pulled off the right prototype, and they could definitely tackle it in a major way.
So podcasting's taking off. Audio's taking off. Audio has institutional money behind it. What are you guys planning on rolling out in the next 6 months?
Well, it should probably take a hint from my co-opetition, you know, Mr. Jobs, and my old friends at Google, and not comment on such questions. Speaking broadly, one thing we promised and very clearly and demoed in a lot of cases is the create tools. It's a major part of our offerings, whereas what we planned on doing from the beginning is make it really easy to not just find and consume podcasts, but create them and publish them. So that's an obvious one that involves a few different things. It involves in the browser recording tool that allows you to do some cool stuff, but as simple as possible for producing a podcast. There's a phone posting mechanism, going back to the audio blogger stuff, which is sort of, we see as an entry-level podcasting tool. So anyone who can leave a voicemail can podcast. And then there's a bunch of services around the publishing, which we hope to help as well, from the keeping stats to hosting a site to integrating it with a blog or another website, offering one-click subscription to users, that type of stuff. And then on the other side, on the flip side, we have major initiatives to help with the discovery problem. When we're sitting down and thinking about what podcasting needed early on and the parallels with the blogging world, I saw that one of the things that happened with blogs is the ability to publish far outstripped the ability to find and consume the content early on. So what we got all the time is people coming to Blogger and saying, well, give me blogs to read, and our mechanisms for doing that were really poor. In fact, early on we had directory and search and some other things planned, and we actually had directory and search on the site, but we had to kind of scale those back and focus on the publishing tool just because we were lacking resources. But I think that's even still a problem with blogs. Like, people hear about blogs, get introduced to the blogging world, any medium where there's millions of potential content sources and everybody's interested in slightly different things, that's obviously a huge problem. And then if you apply that to audio, it's 10 times worse because the ability, you can't scan audio visually and it costs, you know, it takes time to download. And so that discovery and sending people to the stuff they're most interested in, I think, is a huge problem. It's going to take a lot of tools and it's going to take a lot of technology to really solve that, right? And we see that as something that we want to help solve. And part of the way we're going to do that is by building the social and community aspects around the content. So we have a few of those now, so such as the community-driven tagging mechanisms, comments, the contacts, so you can see what other people are subscribed to as a way to find subscriptions yourself. But we plan to do a lot more of that. So it's all about helping people when they come in the door go away with the stuff they're most compelled by and interested in.
Well, it's very exciting, and I'm really looking forward to hopefully more people finding Venture Voice through Odeo.
I can't guarantee anything, but I think that'll happen.
Hey, well, I appreciate that, and thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I enjoy listening to the show, and if you can find it in my subscriptions on Odeo, so at least some people will find it that way, hopefully.
Yeah, I remember when you gave me the beta, I think you were the first one on Odeo subscribed, so it was a real honor. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Well, you heard it here first. Odeo has just received institutional money to continue to grow their business with, so hopefully we'll continue to see more exciting things from Ev. If you have news to break, big or small, or even just a few comments, be sure to email us or drop a comment on the website. The website is at www.venturevoice.com. Our email is talk@venturevoice.com, and we look forward to hearing from you. Till next time.